Sitting in a living room, sitting on the porch. It's your words, gonna light that torch. Tell it in a city park, tell it in a bar, tell it in the backseat of your grandma's car. No tales too pure, our failures lure. The poor house sure wants to hear what's bubbling in your brain.
All right, well, welcome to the third installment of the Prompt Write for Tales from the Poorhouse. It's gotten cold. There's snow on the ground. There are no leaf blowers like there was in the last episode. There might be snow blowers. We've had a few beers, we've done our prompt, we've written for an hour, we've revised for another half an hour, and we're ready to tell stories. The prompt this week was The Deep Hole, so you should hear that in every story. You might also hear about a pinhole camera, and an atlas, and also a pair of 3D glasses. So, welcome to the show. Our first reader tonight is Danny Purcell. As you hear this, Danny Purcell is practically guaranteed to be drinking a beer, smoking a cigarette, sleeping, or pissed off. She likes ambiguous nouns and other girls with boys' names. Danny.
Allison has dragged me into the bathroom so she can have an audience. I do a line to humor her and watch her do the rest. It is then she decides to endow me with some of her wisdom.
I used to get sad sometimes, she muses, but there are always things you could be putting into it.
Into what?
Your life, duh.
How?
Coming to know yourself, she says, running her finger beneath the tip of her nose with an exuberant
I have chosen to throw what I get into the deep hole until the pile condenses, imploding inward on itself. It could resemble a junkyard or a dump heap or a compost pile, any one of those things, as it is malleable. Things often rearrange themselves and resurface, but eventually it resets to nothing. Mathematically, it is impossible to dissect, but it contains an estimated 14 drinking-induced comas, 32,483 cigarette butts, 52 large pizzas from the gas station around the corner. Edges protruded, dusted with cut coke, shrouded in old tapestries, entire discographies from The Cure and Camera Obscura. The atmosphere dappled in intense make-out sessions with total strangers, two totaled cars, both over 100,000 miles. I tried not to fixate on such things.
You're pretty far gone, dreamer, Allison smiles.
I decide to add another cigarette to the mess. No one else is outside. Muffled masculine voices bellow behind the garage door. The haze in there is too much for my weak corneas to handle. I light my cigarette and watch for traffic, which is non-existent. What looks like a black bag of garbage draped over the curb shifts. I stiffen, watching, and a pink tongue darts out, licks a languid slurp over its dry black nose.
Hey, puppy. Hey, buddy.
Puppy's glazed brown eyes look at me, his tail giving pavement a couple of weak thumps. Maggots wiggle and writhe in a festered open wound, which now has consumed the entirety of his left back leg. The garage door ascends with an exaggerated whine.
What is it?
Wes asks as he stumbles over, his rubbery lips puffing a fat cigar.
Black dog won't move, I offer. Looks like he's dying. There's always a solution for that.
For what?
Clearing the road.
You aren't serious. He gives me a look that says he is completely serious.
Well, can't I just call animal control or something? I bet they'd have him out of here by morning.
He shakes his entire upper torso no and ambles over. I'm sick of looking at this thing. He lifts his steel-toed boot and the dog looks up trustingly at him. Thump, thump, thump. I can't even say no. The boot flashes down and the skull gives a sickening crack. My mouth turns to sour burnt paper. The enormous dead dog, his maggot-infested leg, his sad trusting eyes drops to the top of the pile. before he has absorbed the air, pulsates and begins to quiver, shimmering in the tremulous beating wings of 1,000 newborn flies.
All right. That's a happy story.
I don't know.
Ben Wheeler is a first-year student in MSU's MFA program. In an alternate reality, he is a warrior poet who lives on a battleship made of skulls. It's Ben Wheeler.
This is called Double Meat. I'm like 100% sure that the girl at the sandwich shop is in love with me. I know this because she gives me double meat even when I don't ask, and she doesn't charge me. I go there even when I'm not hungry just to see her. I've been a vegetarian ever since I was 12. Oh, sorry. I've been a vegetarian ever since when I was 12. I choked on a turkey bone at Thanksgiving, necessitating my Uncle Roger, who is enormous like a shaved gorilla, smacking me so hard on the back that I went face first into the table and broke my nose. But greater loves have been based on worse misunderstandings. Her name is Stacy, and after a while I start to follow her home. Nothing creepy, just want to see where she lives. Where she lives is an apartment building a mile from the sandwich shop. If she had known that I was there, behind that bush, I'm sure she would have asked me inside. I'm like 100% sure. A week later, I've made a little hole inside an old pine tree at the edge of her yard. I have it stocked with a couple cameras and a notebook so I can mark her arrivals and departures. It's all very scientific. I want so badly to come out of my hole to catch her on Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays when she comes out of the building to go to work, but our love is like a complicated pastry recipe. If you take it out of the oven too soon, it will be gross. So I have to wait. But I put some candy bars into my hole under the pine tree, and I've made a space between the branches so I can peer into her downstairs neighbor's window while she's watching those talk shows where they talk about crazy people. Sometimes I have nightmares about Stacy, the sandwich girl, being crazy. I think it would be hard trying to love a crazy person, but I would love her anyway. Our love is like a sandwich that can always be eaten, no matter how full it is. Stacy switches over to nights, and I have to change my routine. I go to the sandwich shop and get my order, double meat again. The sound of that turkey being slapped home is better to me than fireworks or a whole naked legion of cupids. There is a dog who lives in the backyard of a house a block from Stacy's, so I peel that rapturous meat off the crispy toasted bread and toss it over. That leaves the bread, still with meaty residue and some soggy pickles, but I eat it because its taste is the taste of love. Stacy has a routine. She gets home at 10:30. One of these days, we will have a conversation about how she leaves her clothes around the bedroom, and also about how she should keep her blinds pulled when she undresses, but that will come later. For now, I lay in my hole beneath the tree, eat my bread, and watch as she moves from room to room. She only has two, turning lights on and turning lights off. The next week, I move into phase two and begin to trailer at the grocery store, half an aisle behind her. Stacy likes potato chips and those little things you eat whole that aren't oranges but are like oranges. Stacy buys her gas at the same place every week, always uses the same pump, except for one Thursday when some guy in a truck took it, and I wanted so badly to go over there and impart some harsh wisdom, but Stacy just took it in stride. She's always been so much more understanding than me. It's one of the many ways we complete each other. I hadn't slept at my apartment for a week. I had a sleeping bag and a little Coleman stove I could cook soup on there in my little hole under the big pine tree. Once a dog came sniffing around and I punched it in its face. Then it was Friday. She got up that morning and opened her second story window to let in a nice breeze. And that night she left looking very nice, but then again, my lady always looks nice. I waited for an hour to see if anyone was going to do something about that open window. There were all kinds of crazy people around. Someone might climb the dumpster under the window and break in and steal her underwear. I realized that this was my moment. I would scale that dumpster and close the window, and then I would send her secret letters with codes hidden in them, coded with numbers and letters that spelled out my true feelings, illuminated our destiny. I would make reference to crises averted, of thefts prevented, of possessions maintained. I shimmied my way out of my hole, which now had dirt walls with some little recesses into which I had placed things like an alarm clock and some gum. And I climbed up onto the dumpster. I had to be careful. There were people on the sidewalks. I climbed the dumpster and popped the screen, tumbled into her bedroom. It was just as I'd imagined it when I'd been looking at her undressing in it. She had a lot of pictures on the wall that I hadn't been able to see, little black and white images of buildings and people who looked like the landmarks and residents of a town full of ghosts. I picked some of her underwear up and hid it under the rug, where they would be safe from crazy lingerie thieves. I hadn't been paying attention to the other room. I was too busy to hear the click and the squeak as her front door opened. But when I heard it, the first thing I thought of was that the thieves had somehow picked the lock. When I went into the other room to subdue them, I found Stacy and some big tan guy. The big guy said something inappropriate, and Stacy screamed, and the guy chased me into the bathroom, where he threw me onto the tile and hit me with a handheld shower head. When I was unconscious, one of them called the cops, and now I'm here, in jail, serving out time. I miss my hole. I miss my Stacy. I have to share my cell with a skinny Russian guy who never stops talking about this coffee shop he's going to open, Creme de la Kremlin, when he gets out. Wednesday is sandwich day at the cafeteria, but the guy there never gives me double meat. I'm told it's not advisable to request double meat in prison. And every Friday, for visiting hours, I sit at the desk with my little phone and wait for Stacy to come to tell me what a mistake she's made.
Yeah.
Nice work. I actually know a guy who kind of lived that.
In certain respects, yeah.
He really liked this girl who was in one of his classes, and he didn't really follow her around, but one time he...
Like he studied with her?
Not really. He just liked her from afar, and he knew where she lived. You know, they'd walk along the same path.
Together.
They had a class together.
Students.
Yeah, and then he took a lot of drugs and then took off all his clothes and scaled the building and went into her apartment in the middle of the night. And her boyfriend played for the University of Kansas football team. They beat the fuck out of him, and they called the cops that he was naked. And she said, you know, I went and he's like, I can't believe I did that. I thought that I could climb better without my clothes. I wasn't trying to, but it was a felony. So that's rough.
That's exactly how I got my wife. I mean, I guess it doesn't work out for everyone.
No, it's appropriate in Utah, perhaps out of Kansas.
Yeah.
It's a Mormon pouring ritual. Man went walking the other day, found himself alone again. Down on his knees and began to pray. Woman calling on the telephone says she lost everything she owns. Apologized for too much lying before she took her own. Surviving.
That's a great big hole from Lee Hankey, excellent Mankato musician. It's my favorite big hole song of all time. Now back to the stories.
KC Ulysses Fab hates intolerance. He hates intolerance so much, he doesn't let his own lactose intolerance stop him from eating 2-pound bricks of cheese from time to time. He hates dogs, though. KC.
We were making a list of places we would go, things we would do during the week between our last day of class and our day of graduation. So far we had, 1, plant a tree on the 50-yard line of the high school football field. 2, spray paint the giant hillside M outside Platteville green. 3, take a tour of the old-style brewery in La Crosse. 4, try to see the Grim Reaper in the State Penn Cemetery in Anamosa. We doubted the legend was true, but still, why not? 5, find the old Happy Chef statue that the city of Ryan bought and turned into a happy umpire in the outfield of the town's baseball field and spray paint him green and plant a tree in front of him. 6, find Michael Jordan's house in Galena and spray paint Larry Bird in green letters on his front door. In geology class, we were told that there was this underground cavern, though, somewhere west of Dubuque. When Mr. Bexon wasn't too busy staring at the nubile young females in my class, he told us about the Bernard Cavern, just south of Whitewater Canyon. This hole, he said, is so deep that if you dropped a rock, it would take 8.5 seconds before it hit the underground lake. 8.5 seconds, he told us, was a long time. Very long indeed. He winked at Lauren Brinney in the front row. My best friend Quincy turned to me. We should throw a cat down there. He hated cats. He has no soul. Add it to the list, I asked. I also have no soul. And so now we have 7. Throw a cat down a deep hole somewhere in rural Dubuque County. When the day came, I packed my car. We were going to do this thing in one trip. It may take days, I said to my mom. Maybe weeks. Graduation is in 8 days, she said, between puffs of her Pall Mall menthol. If you miss that, I will set you on fire in your sleep. I made a mental note to ask Quincy if we should light the cat on fire before sending it down to the center of the earth. Hey, champ, my dad said. He was staring through the windows of my minivan. What's with the spray paint? It's Quincy's, I said. We're gonna go work on his Eagle Scout project. Hogwash. He couldn't even get past the Weeblos. He opened the sliding door and grabbed the Walmart bag of spray paint. Have fun, sunshine, he said. I picked up Quincy at his house. Bad news, bud, I said. Daddy-o confiscated the paint. Quincy shook his head. My mom took the trees, too. And apparently the old-style brewery closed down years ago. Well, there went our entire list. How our kids are supposed to celebrate the end of their high school career if the adults kept taking away all the spray paint and all the small trees. So now what, I asked. What does that leave on the list? Chucking a cat down into the earth, Quincy said. We decided to go looking for Mr. Bexon's deep hole, which shouldn't be hard the way he was talking about how big it was. Maybe we should call Lauren Brinney and ask her. I'm sure she's seen it, Quincy said. After about a half hour of looking at an atlas inside my car in the parking lot of McDonald's, we found this Whitewater Canyon just outside this hick town of Bernard. Finally, after an hour of tracking down a stray long-haired cat downtown, we were able to trap the animal in one of the canvas sacks that once held the roots of Quincy's confiscated trees. We tossed the bag into the back of the van where it rolled around like a pulsating bag of angry stray cat. And off we were with the cat's howling and pleading its case not very well. We found the place at the end of a gravel road, branched off a gravel road, branched off another gravel road. Our mouths were gritty with dust, our ears full of strained meowing, our minds full of the desire to place a cat in a battle against gravity. The cavern was not impressive. The hole in the ground was itself only about a foot and a half wide. A brick ring 2 feet high surrounded it. "Get the cat," I said. Quincy ran and grabbed the cat. The bag squirmed, then it was still. Then it pulsed, but then it was still. The cat couldn't make up its mind. "You don't have a lighter, do you?" I asked. Quincy shook his head. "Do you want to do this, or should I?" "Go ahead," I said. With that, he chucked the squirming bag of cat down the deep hole. We stood silent, waiting to hear the splash. 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi, 4. Then we heard it, the faint swell of reverberation from a bagged cat hitting water. 4 seconds, Quincy asked. "Mr. Bexon lied to us." We felt embarrassed for ourselves, for him, and we felt cheated. We would never be able to look at Mr. Bexon in the same way again. Fiend.
Anthony grew up elsewhere, but that's not an excuse. He's here now, but yeah, he's cold. And he's Anthony Rosso. Welcome, Anthony.
I don't know, there haven't been a lot of titles, that have been said, but this is my love letter to Tom Waits, actually. Over there, some other fans here that can relate.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Makes it easier for me. I crawl in deep holes because it's so cold. I think if I crawl down far enough, I'll be warm. The Earth's core is so is so down there. Tom Waits once said he was digging down to China with a silver spoon. I think he had it right. Though that was Mule Variations and Blue Valentine was his best album. My dad likes Foreign Affairs. I don't. But what is good about Foreign Affairs is that it's the Jack and Neil song. Call it Jack and Neil. It's about them traveling the country. I don't know if they had an atlas or not. Maybe. Blue Valentine is great because of the song Christmas Card from a Hooker in Minnesota. It's about this gal who writes a letter to a guy and then tells him how much he loves him, how much she loves him. And then at the end asks for bail money. Waits once said the only time he has his drinking problem is when he doesn't, is when he can't find a drink. He also said that he would rather have a bottle in front of him than a frontal lobotomy. He lives in Northern California now, which is interesting because I have driven through there. I want to knock on his farm door. Tom. Yeah. One from the Heart sucked as a film, but the soundtrack was pretty badass. Coppola is brilliant, but yeah, he botched that one. He wouldn't answer the door anyhow. But if he did, I would tell him that my girlfriend thinks he talks instead of sings, and that's stupid. But I would tell him that Nighthawks from the Diner is badass, and he should just do that every time. Then I would tell him it's the crack of dawn, and I would like to ask him a question.
Jim Burt can't think of anything to say about himself, so he won't. But in doing so, he just did. And that's how Jim writes. Jim.
Franklin was lost in the woods. And he didn't know where he was, either. He was looking for something fantastic, magical, mythical, maybe even weird, man. That's what he said he was looking for. Something weird, man, something weird. He took his big black pinhole camera, and drove to the edge of the world in search of something weird. He found a used Rand McNally Road Atlas at a garage sale and followed the green highlighted line of someone else's adventure. He was sure that if he put on the 3D glasses that he also got at the garage sale and stepped into the woods, he would see the underside of the world, the real world, not the two-dimensional distraction that kept him unexposed in that tiny dark chamber of his own metaphorical camera obscura. So he went into the woods, tripping over things. He couldn't see. Suddenly there was a flash, a laugh, a shuffle of brush, a snap of branches, and Franklin was sure something was afoot, or that maybe his foot was something. The 3D glasses were leading him into the deep hole of his subconscious and the bottom of his backpack of flashbacks that was slung around the limp shoulders of his mind. After all this time, finally, here were those flashbacks he was promised back in 69. He had found the real world, and it was something weird, man. But it wasn't. He was looking at his foot. The glasses slipped off as he looked down, and a jay flew by his head, laughing at him. Get the glasses! Get the glasses! Look and see! Look and see! It landed in a tree and burst into flames. He fumbled with his pinhole camera as he aimed it at the burning jay. He couldn't figure out how to work the camera and dropped it. When he bent down to pick it up, his foot was wearing the 3D glasses and thought that Franklin was something weird. Well, let's be frank about this, the foot said. Suddenly, there was a flash, a shuffle in the brush, a snap of branches. It was a different flash, shuffle, and snap than the earlier ones. Or was it? Franklin needed the 3D glasses to see, for real, what was there. His foot fought him for a while, but he was triumphant and was looking into the forest again with many eyes once he got the glasses off his foot. The smoke from the burning jay clouded his judgment, and he set off through the wood. His foot stayed behind and set up the pinhole camera for what was sure to be a shot of something weird, man. Standing under the branch that the burning jay was clipped to, Franklin spun his head around like Regan from The Exorcist, and his many eyes landed on what looked like the Lucky Charms leprechaun saddled on the back of the Super Sugar Crisp bear. They were singing something about a flash, shuffle, and snap, and some crack and pops, and galloping deeper into the magical forest. Franklin followed, the 3D glasses inside out and sliding off his face, as the surreal creatures lured him through the pinhole of the dark chamber and into the deep hole of the shallow fullness.
Yay, it's our first psychedelic. This is a psychedelic story.
Sitting in a living room, sitting on the porch. It's your words, gonna light that torch. Tell it in a city park, tell it in a bar. Tell it in the backseat of your grandma's car. No tales too pure, our failures lure. The poor house sure wants to hear what's bubbling in your brain.
That's all for part one of The Big Hole. Thanks to KMSU for broadcasting us. Catch the second part next week, same time.